A controversial natural gas liquids pipeline is about to go online, but there have been a lot of obstacles, from leaks to protests.
My parents are still paying taxes on this land right now. They will continue to pay taxes on this land while Sunoco profits off of it with their pipelines.
I'm Carol Holzapfel. This week on the Allegheny Front, the rocky start of the Mariner East pipeline. And Western Pennsylvania is well known for coal and steel, but salt was also big business.
Salt crystals would form, and they'd be scooped out and put in an area to be dried.
Plus, migrating birds perform a neat trick before they head south.
It's like watching smoke go back down a chimney. It's amazing.
Those and more environmental stories are coming up on the Allegheny Front. Stay with us. An explosion along a recently completed natural gas pipeline destroyed a home and prompted evacuations in western Pennsylvania. No injuries were reported. The Revolution Pipeline, owned by Energy Transfer Partners, only began transporting gas in the week before the explosion. For State Impact Pennsylvania, the Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier reports, investigators believe a landslide triggered the blast.
It happened right before 5 a.m. on a Monday morning. Gary Ciccone was in his house getting ready to go to work.
And I heard this gigantic whoosh, not an explosion. It was just like something igniting. I looked out the windows. It's daylight outside.
Other neighbors described a fireball 150 feet high in the woods behind Ciccone's quiet street in Center Township, Beaver County. The Revolution Pipeline is a 24-inch gathering line built to transport natural gas from Butler County to a processing facility in Washington County. It only started receiving gas on September 3rd, but a company spokeswoman said it wasn't yet at full capacity. Ciccone said pipeline workers had been at his house only days before, finishing up earthwork along the pipeline route. Another neighbor, Tom DeMarco, said the explosion woke him up. His first thought was for his neighbors, Sam and Joyce Rosati, whose house was closest to the explosion.
The gas line explosion is what first thing came to my mind, and because I know where the gas line runs and the location of my neighbor's house, and the wind was pushing towards his house, and man, it was ugly. It was darn ugly.
The Rosattis escaped unharmed, but their home was destroyed. Officials think a landslide related to heavy rains was the cause. High-voltage power lines were also damaged. The Pennsylvania Public Utility Commission is investigating. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Reed Frazier.
So the pipeline that we just heard about, the Revolution Pipeline, was built in part to feed natural gas liquids to another pipeline, the Mariner East 2. Now, the Mariner East 1 is already up and running with natural gas, and the Mariner East 2 is being built to help get natural gas liquids like ethane and propane from western Pennsylvania to Philadelphia. They're the building blocks of plastic, and they'll also be exported overseas. But the Mariner East 2 has had a lot of problems. The company building the pipeline, Sunoco Logistics, has taken land through eminent domain, and that's angered landowners, like the Gerharts in Huntington County.
You know, this is private property. My parents are still paying taxes on this land right now. They will continue to pay taxes on this land while Sunoco profits off of it with their pipelines.
And then there are the spills. In the new State Impact Pennsylvania podcast, Energy Explained, Reed Frazier talks with Susan Phillips and John Hurdle about their reporting on the Mariner East 2 pipeline. Here's a piece of that conversation.
You guys have documented dozens of spills and accidents that the pipeline has endured during construction. John, can you fill us in on some of the problems that Mariner East has had?
The drilling problems started pretty much as soon as they started constructing the pipeline in February of 2017. The main problem that the project has had is dozens and dozens of spills of what's called drilling mud, which is essentially a lubricant. It's a clay-based lubricant that the company uses.
The company says it's a non-toxic clay slurry called bentonite, which is often used in things like kitty litter or makeup.
Okay. So do you want me to drink cat litter and Women's Foundation makeup and my water? I don't think so.
DEP, Department of Environmental Protection, started to enforce these problems with drilling mud spills, and they started issuing notices of violation for these incidents, some of which spilled thousands of gallons of drilling mud into wetlands and waterways and private properties. The latest count that I've made is that there are actually 70 notices of violation issued by the DEP, the most recent of which was on August 16th of this year.
Drilling mud is non-toxic, if I'm correct, but why would this be a problem for the environment?
Yeah, drilling mud is a bentonite clay. If it spills into a stream or a wetland, it sort of smothers a lot of the tiny little aquatic life, those little bugs that fish feed on. And so it has an impact, you know, throughout the food chain of a stream or a wetland.
So the company's also had problems with sinkholes.
People woke up and there was a big hole in their backyard.
A sinkhole, now the size of a swimming pool, is in T.J. Allen's backyard. The ground began opening here in November.
While they were doing this 24-hour dig, they created a second sinkhole. This is serious. People can get hurt.
They had been drilling for this pipeline, and what they did was they ran into this certain limestone, which is full of holes. And water and drilling mud, you never know what it's going to do underground if you're drilling in a limestone foundation. But the most dangerous thing that happened was that it exposed the actual Mariner East 1 line, which, remember, had already been built and had already been sending natural gas liquids through the line. And that's really dangerous because if the line is not in a stable foundation, something could happen to it. It could leak. And of course, nobody wants natural gas to leak in general, but natural gas liquids is very combustible. And so what people were afraid of is if that leaked and there was a spark nearby or a lit match or a cigarette or whatever, that could explode. So that was the real fear. And that's what led to the Pennsylvania Public Utility Commission actually shutting down the operation of Mariner East 1 and also halting the construction of Mariner East 2.
You mentioned PUC shutting down the pipeline construction. What's been the reaction from the state to a pipeline with so many violations?
Well, as we were saying before, there's been dozens of these notices of violation issued by the DEP. The PUC, for its part, has been increasingly attentive to the issue in recent months. The construction of Mariner East 2 plus the operation of Mariner East 1 were both shut down, first of all, by a PUC administrative judge. That was back in May. Then her order was only partly upheld by the full PUC a few weeks later. The result of that was that Mariner East 1 was allowed to resume its operations.
What has the DEP done as a result of all these spills into the waters of the Commonwealth? I mean, their mandate is to protect these streams.
One of the three shutdowns that Mariner East has experienced since it's been under construction was in January of 2018, and that lasted for about a month. And when it was lifted, the DEP fined Sunoco. So DEP said that it would take a very rigorous approach to Sunoco's repeated violations, and it has done so.
What has the company's response to all of this been? I don't know if you can characterize it or summarize what the company has said.
They typically say that they meet or exceed all state and federal pipeline construction regulations.
John, in the last few days, you've been writing about a problem that the pipelines had where the company is replacing sections of this multi-billion dollar pipeline a little more than a month before it's supposed to sort of start sending gas through it. What's been going on? Why is the company replacing parts of the pipeline in, and this is predominantly in eastern Pennsylvania, if I have this correctly?
As far as we know, it is. Yes, that's right. And the reason they're doing this is because they've discovered what they call flaws in the coating of the pipeline. The company coats the pipeline in epoxy, which bonds to the steel in the pipeline. And the idea here is to prevent the corrosion of the pipe from the outside.
So are they still insisting that the pipe's going to be online at the, what, end of September?
Yes. In Sunoco's Energy Transfer Partners' latest earning call, they said that their schedule is unaffected. They still aim to be up and running by the end of the third quarter.
There's been a lot of opposition in the, you know, suburbs of Philly to this pipeline going in. I'm just wondering what your take on why that opposition has been so strong there.
Well, what I would say is that there's a lot of awareness that the pipeline is going through a very densely populated area, the western suburbs of Philly. The critics of this project say that it's outrageous that a pipeline carrying these highly explosive natural gas liquids should have been routed through such a densely populated area in the first place. And I think that's why, that's really what's motivated a lot of people.
If you go out to the suburbs and see where these construction sites are, it's literally in people's backyard. The shale gas, the fracking boom has kind of come to the Philadelphia suburbs, and they're not happy about it.
That was State Impact Pennsylvania reporters Susan Phillips and John Hurdle speaking with the Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier for the new State Impact Pennsylvania podcast, Energy Explained. You can listen to more online at State Impact Pennsylvania or wherever you get your podcasts. This is the Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holsapple. On Ice Mountain in West Virginia, ferns and native flowers are being crowded out by invasive plants. And that's not all.
We're seeing change here, and what that change is associated with, you know, it could be a couple of different things, but we don't think that we're seeing ice accumulation in here as long as we did in the past.
Later on the Allegheny Front, conserving and exploring a unique habitat in Appalachia. Stay tuned. Everyone knows that steel mills and coal mines were a huge part of Pittsburgh's industrial past. But as 90.5 WESA's Amy Sisk reports, southwestern Pennsylvania was once a hub for another industry, salt.
Before refrigerators, salt kept meat from spoiling. It was expensive for the region's earliest settlers. It arrived by boat from England, and horses hauled it across the Appalachians. That leg of the trip took 20 days and led to a steep markup in price. This all changed in the early 1800s, thanks to this spot 40 miles east of Pittsburgh along the Conemaugh River in Indiana County.
Looks like there's a sign up here. It says West Penn Trail at Watson Mine.
This is where a coal mine opened in 1813 to supply fuel to boil brine for the first salt works in western Pennsylvania. But all I could see were trees and a grassy field, so I met up with a local history buff in back of the nearby historical society.
My name's Jack McGuire. I was born and raised here in Salzburg, Pennsylvania.
Salzburg, named for the industry that took off here. McGuire says animals helped lead humans to salt. Deer often congregated around a natural salt lick.
It's just a little crack in the surface of the rock strata.
With salty water, the brine trickling out. A resident named Mrs. Deemer realized one of these salty springs was on her land. Her discovery prompted her neighbor to try to produce salt on a big scale. To do that, William Johnston needed to drill into the source of the brine several hundred feet deep. Johnston used a spring pole drill, like the replica McGuire built near the river.
Is that it?
Yes.
McGuire shows me several wooden poles sticking up out of the ground to help support an iron chisel. It pounded the ground over and over again, with momentum generated by the driller's own body weight.
Probably like a two-man, three-man operation.
Each well took up to 10 months to complete. Once the driller hit the watery brine in the rock below, he switched into production mode and started extracting the liquid. That's where the coal came in. Crews burned it to boil the salty water in big cauldron kettles. McGuire points one out on display.
Salt crystals would form, and they'd be scooped out and put in an area to be dried.
By 1830, the valley was the third largest salt producer in the country. Salt works popped up all over southwestern Pennsylvania. This history is chronicled in Salt in the Conemaugh Valley. It's a massive book written by Bill DeZombeck, who passed away in 2015. Here's his son.
It's exhaustive.
Dave DeZombach is a civil and environmental engineering professor at Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh.
That's the way Dad was, very thorough person, a lot of detail. And, it, you know, it's probably more of a reference book than a take-it-to-the-beach book.
Bill DeZombach researched the subject for years after retiring from the chemistry department at St. Vincent College in La Trobe. He describes a number of wells in Pittsburgh. One driller struck brine along the Monongahela, and the water reportedly gushed out of the ground, shooting 30 feet in the air. I kept coming across references to wells where the 9 Mile Run flows into the Mon, so I went exploring along the confluence in the East End. There's a lot of rocks, wooden boards, looks like there's an old dock. I couldn't find any sign of the old industry, and I stopped short of taking a sip of the water to see if it tasted salty. Although I have yet to find a salt spring, DeZombach lists over 300 salt makers who set up shop before an oversupply sent profits plummeting. I imagine many of these sites are overgrown or covered by roads and buildings, but some of the springs may still be flowing, known only to the deer that roam nearby, licking up the salt. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Amy Sisk.
Recently, a group of Swift fans gathered outside of a Pittsburgh restaurant in anticipation. But these Swifties aren't here for a pop concert or a celebrity sighting. They've gathered together along a side street to witness a natural phenomenon that happens around dusk this time of year, the roosting of chimney swifts.
The square one?
The square one. Although there are two chimneys there, so I think we should keep our eye on both of them. If you go,
Sarah Koenig is conservation director for Audubon Society of Western Pennsylvania, and she's looking up at the chimneys on an old church in Pittsburgh that's been converted to a restaurant. It's noisy here with nearby traffic, the restaurant's exhaust fan, kids practicing football in an adjacent field, but 50 people have their eyes peeled for the little cigar-shaped birds that are just starting to arrive.
I love just kind of seeing them come out of nowhere. It's like, oh, here comes another one, joining the big group.
Koenig says chimney swifts spend their summers in eastern North America breeding, and their winters in the upper Amazon. They're regrouping now to migrate south.
They're like the ultimate urban insectivore because they eat 3,000 to 5,000 insects per day. So they eat mosquitoes and, you know, other biting things that might annoy us.
She says the little birds spend the whole day on the wing, cruising around for insects and even mating in the air. Their tiny short feet can't perch, so the birds have to cling to rough surfaces like the inside of a chimney.
They need the right kind of chimney to go into. It's got to have something that they can grab a hold of. Now there's a lot of chimneys that have steel or aluminum flues, and most of us either have a cap on our chimney or we have the wrong kind of chimney.
Joan Schoaf has been birding for 60 years, but she's never seen swifts go down into a chimney to sleep for the night. Chimney swifts used to roost in hollowed-out trees, but development pushed them to adapt in the city and suburbs. Now they're common in communities with old brick chimneys, but they're near threatened as pesticides reduce their food sources, and even more development means chimneys are becoming a thing of the past.
They chitter like crazy.
Oh, I do. I hear them.
Yeah. It's neat.
Dozens of birds are now swirling around the chimney. It's a dramatic sight against the dark clouds, and they're fast. People have stopped using their binoculars to see them because the individual birds are so hard to keep in their sights. The streetlights are on, too, and we're all shielding our eyes.
It's like watching smoke go back down a chimney. It's amazing.
Rob Potts is an experienced birder who monitors peregrine falcons. He's seen this spectacle before, but he's just as excited as everyone else here.
A couple went down. There's going. There they go. There they go. There they go. There they go.
That was awesome. Right? Wasn't that cool? Is this your first time?
Yeah.
All right, that was amazing.
Eric Blondin is new to all of this. He says he just started dating a serious birder.
I couldn't find my keys the other day. For an hour, I was looking for my keys. And then I'm sitting here and these birds migrate thousands of miles to the same chimney and I couldn't find my keys. Like, right? I don't know, something like this makes me feel small, just kind of in awe of bigger things than me.
The chimney swifts will leave the roost in the morning and they'll leave the area for South America in October. Audubon estimates about 200 birds roosted there that evening. And there's a video of it and an interactive map of roosting sites all over the region at AlleghenyFront.org. The map also shows sites where Audubon and partners have built chimneys for swifts to help increase their habitat. That's at AlleghenyFront.org. This is the Allegheny Front. I'm Kara Holsapple. In Hampshire County, West Virginia, just south of the Pennsylvania border, there's a small mountain ridge called Ice Mountain. Historical records suggest that years ago, ice could be found there, even in the heat of summer. Producer Roxy Todd visited Ice Mountain to find out if she could still spot some ice, and to see the rare plant species that have existed there since the last ice age.
The hike begins at the base of Ice Mountain. Aside from the occasional car, the town of North River Mills is quiet. An old white house with a wooden porch is draped in the shade of three sugar maples. Across the street is a red barn that was built in the 1700s. I'm already dripping with sweat as I enter the forest and begin the hike.
Well, this little thermometer suggests that it looks like it's about 92-ish, 93-ish.
My guides are Rodney Barchus, who recently retired from the West Virginia Nature Conservancy, and Mike Powell, who now works as the land steward for the nonprofit group.
And we're headed up to Ice Mountain, a Nature Conservancy preserve. The preserve is open to the public, but we do ask that people go on one of our guided hikes.
Visitors are allowed to hike here, but only if they're accompanied by guides. Several trained volunteers take people on about 125 guided hikes a year. As we enter the forest, Rodney points to one recent change to Ice Mountain. Small ferns and other native plants are being crowded out by an invasive species called Japanese stiltgrass.
The natural world is changing in part because of changes that we are inadvertently making. We're making changes on purpose, and we're also making changes inadvertently, like bringing in the stiltgrass from Asia, which is now competing, and you can see it's just formed this thick carpet all over the forest floor.
He says stiltgrass is usually spread when visitors hike off the path, accidentally bringing the plant with them on their shoes or clothes. Garlic mustard and even tasty wine berries are also invasive.
I always encourage visitors to Ice Mountain and other places like this to eat as many wine berries as you can.
Mike's job includes organizing a few events each year to help get rid of some of the invasive plants to the forest.
They're just spreading faster than we have the ability to control them.
Which means the weeds are beginning to creep closer to the part of Ice Mountain where most of the rare plants live. Deeper into the forest, the canopy of trees grows thicker. Pine trees and rhododendron crowd the edges of the trail. There's more wildlife, too.
There's a Carolina wren singing that probably likes it because we're down near the creek. There was a few phrases from a wood thrush, a few phrases from a scarlet tanager I heard.
We hike along a creek. Ferns, white pine, and hemlock trees replace the invasive stiltgrass we saw earlier. After about 10 minutes, we pass our first ice vent. Actually, I feel it before I see it. Beside my leg, I feel a breath of cool air, like a refrigerator door is open. Then I see dozens of ice vents that vary in size. Some are as small as my hand, others I could stick my head into. It's kind of like a honeycomb with all these little holes in the hillside rocks.
And at those openings, you start to see and feel the airflow. And on a hot day like today, you can really feel a little bit of cool air being exchanged. And as Rodney mentioned, it becomes a lot more evident.
I go closer to one of the vents and put my face beside the cold air. And in a flash of inspiration, I put a can of seltzer water a few feet in to cool down. These ice vents probably formed thousands of years ago, at the end of the most recent ice age. Extreme, repeated temperature fluctuations between seasons likely cracked open the sandstone rocks in this mountain, creating crevices and holes as far as 50 feet. Rodney explains that water there freezes in the winter and is so well insulated that the mountain creates this underground refrigeration effect year-round.
In the winter, water can flow down through those rocks and kind of gets trapped, and when it's cold, it can freeze. In the cooler months, especially in the winter, cold air can also sink into those rocks.
Today, you can't find ice after April or May, but years ago, it never melted, even in the summer.
Ice Mountain was popular as a place for people to come and make ice cream, oh, at least until the 1920s, maybe into the 1930s.
As the years go by, Ice Mountain seems to lose its ice earlier and earlier each spring.
We're seeing change here, and what that change is associated with, you know, it could be a couple of different things, but we don't think that we're seeing ice accumulation in here as long as we did in the past.
Geologists haven't decided if climate change is responsible for the declining ice, or if it has something to do with people no longer carving out openings in the ice fence. Whatever the causes might be, the good news is that rare plants that have lived here for thousands of years are still thriving. And for now, the invasive species like garlic mustard and stiltgrass haven't moved into this part of the forest. Just a few feet from the largest ice vent are a handful of rare plants that Rodney points out.
This little plant here, some people call it dwarf dogwood, other people call it bunchberry. It is really a dogwood. But it's, again, only 3 or 4 inches tall. It has a beautiful white flower that looks just like the flowering dogwood that blooms in the spring that people are familiar with. So this is one of those northern plants that comes south through the mountains. In West Virginia, where you normally would go to see it, would be someplace like Dolly Sods or Spruce Mountain. But here it is, growing fairly commonly here around these ice vents.
There's also wild rose, partridge berry, oak fern, and a weird-sounding plant called skunk currant.
And if you put your hand down right there, you can feel, as soon as you get the hand down there, you can feel cold air coming up out of the ground where that skunk currant's living.
But the crowning jewel of Ice Mountain is the twin flower.
When it's in bloom, it'll send up a little stalk. It'll have two lovely trumpet-shaped purple flowers that dangle. And it's a very pretty plant.
When plants like twin flowers first appeared in this forest, ancient animals lived in these mountains.
The other things that were living here with the twin flower were caribou and ptarmigan, probably muskox, maybe even things like grizzly bears.
Rodney says he loves visiting places like Ice Mountain to see rare plants that mostly only grow in faraway places like Alaska or Russia or thousands of years ago.
I get to see things that otherwise I would have to be thousands of years away in time or thousands of miles away in distance to see here in West Virginia.
Before we head back, I go to check on my can of seltzer water.
And now she pops a celebratory cold one.
It was in the name of science. Mm-hmm. The temperature inside the ice vent is in the mid-40s. My water tastes amazing. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Roxy Todd in Hampshire County, West Virginia.
Thanks to West Virginia Public Broadcasting and their podcast, Inside Appalachia, for that story. And thanks for joining us on the Allegheny Front. You can always find us on Facebook and Twitter at Allegheny Front. Kathy Naur is the executive producer of our show. I'm Kara Holsapple.
Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Heinz Endowments, the Pittsburgh Foundation, and the Park Foundation. The Richard King Mellon Foundation supports our coverage of conservation. State Impact Pennsylvania is a collaboration among the Allegheny Front, WESA, WITF, and WHYY to cover the Commonwealth's energy economy.